Almost nobody on Earth can get through a single day of news without reading or hearing of some new development related to artificial intelligence. And if you follow the business pages, much of that news is about AI and the enormous companies like NVIDIA, Apple, Alphabet, Meta, Taiwan Semiconductor, and others that actually develop it. Perhaps you've even experimented a little with AI. Maybe it has helped you write a paper or a letter or a thank you note. But what exactly is artificial intelligence? What is it supposed to do? And how exactly is it going to change our lives? I'm John Kiriakou. Welcome to The Whistleblowers. The first time I ever heard of a workable form of artificial intelligence was in 2022 when I read a fascinating and frightening article about an American tech blogger named Lucas Risotto. Risotto decided to recreate a childhood imaginary friend that he had had years earlier using AI. The friend was a microwave oven that he called Magnetron. To do this, he purchased a microwave and merged it with GPT-3, a text-based artificial intelligence system developed by the company OpenAI. GPT-3 mimics human language, creating original sentences when prompted. To populate its brain, OpenAI fed GPT-3 vast amounts of data, everything from Wikipedia to newspaper articles to Reddit posts. Risotto then programmed it with a backstory, which he described as a 100-page book detailing every moment of Magnetron's imaginary life. He then programmed it to turn on when he gave it a command, and he began conversing with it. He later described those conversations as both beautiful and eerie. Why? It was because the microwave actually sounded like a real person, and it sometimes had bursts of anger. At one point, the microwave demanded that Risotto put his head inside so that the microwave could kill him. When Risotto pretended to do so, the microwave actually turned itself on. That was 2 years ago, and 2 years is a lifetime in the world of artificial intelligence. Now, many of us who are not tech wizards are struggling with news and discussions about AI and its relation to things like predictive modeling, adaptive control, generative AI, even neural networks and something called hive mind. And that doesn't even touch on things like deepfakes, which already are causing a stir in elections around the world. How big of an impact is AI going to have on our daily lives? We'll try to get an answer to that question from our next guest. Sean O'Brien is a subject matter expert in cybersecurity, privacy, Web3, and free and open source software called FOSS. Sean is a visiting lecturer at Yale Law School, where he teaches cybersecurity and where he founded the Privacy Lab Initiative. He's the chief technology officer at Panquake, recently launching the Panquake Me Link cleaning, shortening, and archiving service. Sean developed a Web3 and blockchain class at Yale, as well as hacking and cybersecurity at the Lawfare Institute, and was founding head tutor at Oxford University's Cybersecurity for Business Leaders. Sean's expertise has appeared in the New York Times, Forbes magazine, Bloomberg, Popular Science, the Associated Press, NBC News, the Financial Times, Wired, and the New Yorker. Sean, thanks so much for being with us. I've been looking forward to this conversation for a long time.
I'm so happy to be here.
It's a pleasure. I think the best place to start is with the very basics of AI. Can you tell us what exactly is AI? When did technologists begin to develop it, and to what end?
Sure. So artificial intelligence, or this thing that we're now so used to calling AI, it's really something that goes back to the 1950s, believe it or not. When I think about the origins of AI, I like to go all the way back to Alan Turing. Alan Turing, of course, was the big pioneer of the computing systems, the things we now call computers and computer software and so on. The big pioneer from that period who really designed the way in which computers, you know, so-called think, right? And in 1950, Turing had a paper called Computing Machinery and Intelligence. And I encourage folks to go back to that paper. It's very easy to read. He asks in that paper, can machines think? And then the important part is, he says, he believes it to be, quote, too meaningless to deserve discussion. Okay. And what he sort of means by that is, you know, we don't talk about whether or not submarines swim, right? Or, you know, whether airplanes really fly in the way that birds fly, right? We just sort of use these analogies for technology without sort of getting all philosophical about it. And computers certainly can do some amazing tasks, but they are not human brains, right? And I think that's a really important point that gets lost in all this discussion about artificial intelligence, and certainly the branding around calling it intelligence, right, does that. So computers are good at some kinds of problems. They literally will never solve other problems that humans can solve, right? And humans are also very good at certain tasks that computers are very bad at. So we can't crunch large prime numbers, right, or do these complex mathematical problems the same way computers can. But we see, for example, faces in everything, right, when we look at a light socket or so on. And that's because we have biological systems in our brain that basically those cognitive structures are, you know, allowing us to do that very easily, very simply. Now, fast forward to the 1970s, 1980s, when we start having more miniaturization of computer components. This is the era really where artificial intelligence and that concept sort of takes off. And there was a lot of research done around it in that period. And also periods of what they call AI winters. So if you look into the history, you'll find there was sort of a cooling on research and funding for academic research, certainly in artificial intelligence over a number of periods, you know, on and off through the 90s and so on and so forth. What we really now have as AI, you know, ChatGPT, OpenAI, all these other tools, these things are really, you know, sort of built on the corpus of information that the internet can feed into what's called a large language model, right? These LLMs. And that's what we're really calling AI. So it's something that was born sort of in the early 2000s, mid 2010s. And we can go into the details about who's funding it and why they're funding it and so on. But obviously, it's making a big impact on our world.
I had no idea that it's been around so long. Okay, Sean, the technology is developing and advancing at lightning speed, it seems. Is it possible to rein it in?
Sure. So, you know, AI regulation is something my colleagues at Yale and other folks have been working on for a really long time. The writing was sort of on the wall that these kinds of systems, AI, LLMs, et cetera, would be used in some context, you know, even in the legal systems. But certainly governing the rules and the processing of information in this huge global information network we have called the internet, right? So there's been a lot of work on regulation, certainly in the United States, but nothing really solid, right? Now, I do think regulation has a place, but anybody who's been involved in drafting legislation, and I've certainly had my role in that a little bit, it's a difficult thing. You know, by the time these regulations go through all the pipelines and through all the structures that we have, the bureaucracies and so on, they've shifted in such a way that they're often not very useful. To take an example, right, GDPR, General Data Protection Regulation in Europe, you know, that's had a real impact on the landscape of privacy worldwide. The version of that that we sort of emulated in the United States is the CCPA, right, the California Consumer Protection Act. And that act is sort of like GDPR light, I like to call it. It removes some of the strong, you know, controls that I think GDPR had. And I'm seeing that a little bit with this AI regulation already. That said, I think real, you know, grassroots movements, you know, especially local movements, you know, petitioning municipal governments and, you know, getting things like bans on facial recognition technology, which have been very successful in the United States. You know, those sorts of things are powerful and they do have a real world impact. Certainly, you know, getting your local town or city to stop scanning your face from street cameras, you know, is a good thing as far as I'm concerned. And that's something that can be done sort of at the regulatory level. At the larger level, I'm not so convinced. And certainly when we have, you know, no control over entities like these private entities, big tech and so on, Amazon Ring cameras and everything else, you know, that sort of thing is not going to be so easily controlled. Where our information systems are concerned, we don't have control over them now anyway, right? The Facebooks and the Googles and so on. So this is just another layer that is unfortunately quite problematic. And I don't think regulation is going to have a really big impact there.
Let's get into some of the more complicated aspects of AI. We hear terms that I have no understanding of, like predictive modeling, adaptive control, generative AI. Can you tell us what these terms mean and what the uses are for these technologies?
Sure. So what we're most familiar with, and certainly a lot of people got really familiar with in the last couple of years, is generative AI. ChatGPT and these other prompt-based systems, you know, the new helper system, Copilot that Microsoft is putting into, you know, shoving into Microsoft Office and GitHub and all these things. I call them nagging systems or nagware, but still, that's actually being kind of polite to them. But those systems are generative AI. So they're provided with a prompt or some other starting point by the user, and then they create text or images or some other content that they generate. So you take a huge amount of data, you shove it into a learning model, and then statistically, you know, the algorithm is able to figure out, and this is a huge oversimplification, but it's able to figure out a certain amount of rules and guess basically what you're looking for based upon the input that you give it.
Thank you, Sean. We're going to take a short break, and when we come right back, we are going to speak with Sean about what to expect in the near future from developments in AI and how we protect ourselves and our information. Stay tuned. Welcome back to The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. We're speaking with Sean O'Brien. He's a lecturer in law at Yale Law School with expertise in cybersecurity, privacy, and mobile device forensics. He's the assistant director for technology at Yale's Office of International Students and Scholars and a PhD candidate in law at the University of South Africa. He founded Yale's Privacy Lab in 2017, an initiative of the Information Society Project at Yale Law School. Thanks again for being with us, Sean.
Happy to be here. It's been an amazing conversation.
One of the major issues related to AI in the immediate term is the problem of deepfakes. These are videos that look to be 100% legitimate that are actually completely fake. Many of them are very crude, and we see those every day on Facebook and TikTok and elsewhere, but some of them are actually quite sophisticated. How can we stop people from creating videos that make it look like, for example, world leaders are admitting to crimes on camera or taking harmful policy positions or making themselves look foolish?
So, unfortunately, deepfakes are really problematic. I'm very glad you brought that up. Certainly, it's a topic that will be more and more prominent as, you know, for example, the election cycle here in the US heats up, as it very much did the other day with the debate. But at any rate, you know, the first thing we need to think about and the first lesson we should learn from this is talking about, you know, where these deepfakes came from and how the software was trained to do this sort of thing. And the way that happened was large databases were built of people's facial information, right? Academics, you know, private researchers, you know, photos scraped off of the internet, many, many millions of them, you know, all of the surveillance cameras that have sort of just suddenly appeared around us everywhere, certainly in places like airports and so on, but well beyond that, you know, the grocery store even. These cameras have been collecting data about our faces, the relation between different parts of our faces, you know, getting very, very good at learning, you know, the same way I was talking about these other models learning, you know, like ChatGPT to talk back to us or to regurgitate information in a way that's convincing. These models were learning how to create faces, right? How to understand faces, how to hypothetically recognize faces, although we can get into how biased and bad that technology has been. But certainly, you know, deepfakes have proven, you know, that you can masquerade as someone else and create a video and certainly create propaganda and all other types of mischief around that. I think the important thing to remember here first is, and it's good news, at least for now, is that we do have software that can do a reasonably good job of detecting these kinds of things, right? The same way that software is reasonably good at detecting big blocks of text that come out of ChatGPT, right? We do have software that can recognize, okay, the edges on the face here, the way that the compression artifacts are in this video, we can tell it's been edited, that it's not the original video, that there's a problem with mismatch of colors and resolution and lighting and all that sort of thing, right? But really, when we get down to it, this conversation is about the information system, right? It's about, okay, do we allow information to flow through this beautiful internet that we have? Do we allow people to literally, you know, look at things that are difficult conversations, and but still be able to learn when they're, you know, very young, when they're getting older and becoming adults, and certainly when they're taking action in the world, and some of these folks becoming rather powerful and being able to make quick actions that affect a lot of people? Are these individuals, you know, are they knowledgeable? Have they really learned how to distinguish between something that's real and what's not real, or unlikely and likely? Are they going to pause and take a deep breath before they take some kind of action, right? Before they just kind of type something at the keyboard? I always tell folks, you know, when you're angry, when you're upset, you know, this is a rule for email and everything else, certainly, you know, Twitter, X, whatever it's called, do not just start typing at the keyboard and just sort of regurgitating onto the internet. That stuff does live forever and certainly can live forever. But
another big problem, at least here in the United States, is the creation of deepfake nudes, where people, in many cases children, are made to appear to be nude in videos. In fact, these are computer-generated bodies attached to actual children, or the entire image is computer-generated. And it's a crime. So how do we protect ourselves and our children from this kind of activity?
Sure. So, I mean, look, the attention economies and the clickbait, that's a bad enough problem with deepfakes. But I'm glad you sort of touched on this, because this is obviously extremely serious. So the acronym that's been used for this sort of content is CSAM, or Child Sexual Abuse Material. It's sort of a law enforcement acronym, but it's become what folks have been using. And it does encompass this kind of thing, you know, so-called revenge porn, or, you know, child material where they're, you know, putting someone's face on a body and this awful stuff, right? It's obviously extremely problematic. It's obviously something that most folks object to quite strongly. I do think it's something that will exist in some form as humans, you know, have the kinds of issues that they have. Now, I can give an example in the real world where one of these big image generation software models, an AI piece of software called Stable Diffusion, they did actually fork their data set and start removing content that could be objectionable, including CSAM, or I don't know how they detected it was CSAM imagery, but supposedly that they removed it. Those sort of controls, you know, are hit or miss, and we can have, you know, societal conversations around them. We certainly should. But of course, you know, you can't put the genie back in the bottle, right? This is really a whack-a-mole game, not that different than trying to, you know, stop malware and ransomware and, you know, all kinds of bad stuff on the internet that can infect computers and disrupt networks. You're going to have a hard time completely removing this stuff.
We even talk about militaries and their development of AI, but what role should academia have? How can these outside substantive experts be helpful?
I think academia could have the role, and should have the role, that it should have with other situations, you know, where they need to reflect on the societies around them, you know, provide expertise, as you said, you know, provide research and actually invest in time, energy, and money, of course, into researching these things. And then providing that information to the public for free so they can access it, which often doesn't happen with these journal systems, right? And also in a form that the public can understand and actually have a real dialogue about. Academics should be courageous. They tend not to be, right? One of the things that happens in academia is you get entrenched and you get complacent, and everybody sort of thinks, you know, there's going to be some day when I'm so high up in, you know, this sort of ladder in academia that I can speak my mind. And certainly some places, you know, and some folks, you know, get away with quite a lot, so to speak, are able to speak their mind and are able to do the research that they'd like to do. I don't have to tell you, I'm sure there's certainly a lot of examples of academics being, you know, sort of removed or put to the sideline or blacklisted in some way, you know, because of their views, because of what they've said, because of the type of research they were doing, even if they had very strict standards. So I think academia's role should be highlighting the issues. And I do know some very courageous academics who have been working on this. I mentioned some of the regulatory stuff. But there's a lot of other research out there. It's certainly very fertile ground for a conversation. I want to see that conversation go beyond the Ivy Tower, you know, and being at Yale University, of course, you know, I mean, I really do believe that we need to actually have real conversations with the public, with the surrounding communities around these universities and so on. You know, I'm a native New Havener and someone who's at Yale, right? So I really see the issues that can happen, the clashes that can happen between the general public and a university, a very powerful and rich university, you know, and the general public and the community surrounding that university. So we need to have those conversations and we need to be serious about it. The role academics have traditionally played, unfortunately, with AI is actually building these systems and sort of unquestionably sort of saying, hey, we'll worry about the ethics later. There's been a lot of that. And I'm not just talking about so-called artificial intelligence or large language models and so on. I'm talking about these big sort of data surveillance systems. There's been a lot of private investment in universities, and certainly university endowments are wrapped up in big tech, Facebook's, Google's, et cetera. And, you know, there's been a lot of work on how to analyze data on individuals, on people, and study them, you know, from this sort of automated, semi-automated, these huge surveillance systems. And AI being tacked onto that is problematic. You know, the facial recognition technology, those systems that now are so commonplace, a lot of that work was done in academia and done with data sets where they were taking pictures of people's faces at universities. And that early work, that information is now still a part of these big data sets that, you know, power OpenAI and all these other things, you know, Stable Diffusion, Midjourney, all these other models. So I'm not sure what academia's role will be, but, you know, I hope that we can turn the corner here and we can have a serious adult conversation and it's not just going to be about, you know, money, money, money.
Finally, Sean, I want to get back to this crazy story that I told in the introduction. Tech blogger Lucas Rizzuto programmed a microwave oven that later tried to kill him. Well, we've all seen the movie iRobot. The prime directive is supposed to be to not harm human life. Is that just in Hollywood? Is AI something that should cause us to fear for our safety if it's not regulated?
So-called Internet of Things, right? Whether we use that term IoT anymore in the future, I don't know. It seems to be dying. But, you know, these devices which are internet connected, almost always internet connected, but then also, you know, way, quote unquote, smarter than they, you know, should be. Microwaves that are giving you recipes for some reason. You know, these kinds of things are problematic. I don't see them as killer robots. Sort of some of the reasons I stated earlier. I think the real problems we have to worry about from sort of a security standpoint are the fact that these systems are really difficult to patch and upgrade. So, you know, they're not based on, you know, open source software that can be, you know, easily modified and observed. When they are, they're baked into firmware, baked into chipsets, locked down and sandboxed in such a way that even the manufacturer will have a hard time pushing patches and security updates to these devices. So they tend to be used, and I've certainly demonstrated in some of our classes and so on, they can be used in these huge botnets where they really do damage on the internet. They can attack healthcare systems. They can attack all kinds of systems. They can deliver ransomware. I mean, we're seeing a huge issue, which affected me directly, with car dealerships in the U.S. You know, I had to go get a used car because my other one was a piece of crap, frankly. And, you know, it was hours and hours of faxing and paperwork and so on and going back to the old systems and people literally walking down the street to check in with folks. Because, you know, those computer systems are gone. Now, that's car dealerships. We're not talking about things that are much more vital and can have much bigger impact on people's livelihood and health and safety and so on. I brought up hospitals. We know about the big WannaCry issues, you know, geez, not quite a decade ago, but, you know, still, we've been living with ransomware for nearly a decade now. And these backdoors, frankly, and obviously we should bring this back full circle here to some of the real central issues, these backdoors are built, funded by entities like the NSA, right? They're made inside the CIA. They're using military contractors, Pentagon contractors, who are building these systems to have backdoors in devices like microwaves so that they can be exploited and used as so-called cyber weapons. We know ransomware comes from an NSA backdoor that was purposefully inserted into Microsoft software, right? We know that it was patched quietly by the NSA, and Microsoft basically tried to cover that up in a very sort of clunky and clumsy way, but they tried to. And now we're all living with that, and it's having very serious implications on everybody, and not just on industry, but on people's real livelihoods and their health, right? So microwaves are one thing. This prime directive stuff, you know, I mean, these aren't thinking animals or humans you can build ethics into in that way. You can build certain rule sets so that machines try to not do certain things. But of course, machines can be hacked, modified, rules can be changed. And it's something obviously that I teach. When we have governments and these extra governmental entities purposefully building and storing exploits, right, and vulnerabilities and trying to break into systems in so-called cyber war, these devices are going to continue to be dangerous. It doesn't matter what rule sets we program them with. If they're purposefully broken by others and used, you know, in some malicious way.
Thank you, Sean, for explaining to us this marvelous and sometimes scary world of AI. Just about everybody involved in the development of AI supports some form of government intervention and regulation. Sam Altman, the CEO of OpenAI, has said that AI could design biological pathogens. It could hack into computer systems. Meta CEO Elon Musk said that AI's development is moving too quickly to be healthy for society. The reality is that if Elon Musk is wrong about AI and we regulate it, then who cares? But if Elon Musk is right about AI and we don't regulate it, everybody in the world will care. But by then it might be too late. I'd like to thank our guest, Sean O'Brien, for being with us today. And thank you to our viewers for joining us for another episode of The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. Please follow me on Substack @John Kiriakou. We'll see you next time.